Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Chominski about the new Physician's Assistant Program in UNC's Allied Health Department. This is an exciting new program at UNC, not a new program nationally, but one that is really tailored to help address our primary care and rural health service needs in our state.
Very excited to talk with Dr. Chominski. Christy, I know you've worked with extended providers like nurse practitioners and physician assistants, and one of my first experiences working with them in the state of North Carolina showed how important they are to protecting rural populations as well, which is something near and dear to both of us.
Yeah, looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about it being harder to sleep as you get older.
Let me just ask you. Have you noticed that? I mean, you haven't gotten older yet.
What are you saying, Adam Goldstein?
I'm just wondering if you've like approached your late 30s yet, and have you noticed it? Because what they talk about that is that it's kind of a universal phenomenon. This was an article that was in the journal Neuron, I guess, about nerves, and looking at why is it that we have more difficulty sleeping as we get older? Because it appears to be fairly universal.
Yeah. Well, to answer your question, I was known for being so amazing at falling asleep in any situation in my younger years, and that has, in fact, declined. I'm no longer the sleeping champion.
See, I think it's because of maybe young children, but that could be a different old story.
Lots of different reasons, but this is some research trying to help understand why it is that as people grow older, sleeping soundly, especially the time in deep sleep, tends to decline. And they were looking at the neurological receptors in the brain that pick up the chemicals that tell your body that you're tired, and that those receptors decrease over time, which might be this explanation for why it's more difficult for older adults to recognize when their body's tired. You lay there and then you just can't get your mind to go to sleep.
Yeah, your body can be sleepy, but your brain not. I certainly understand that, but I think some of this also is like what we can do to prevent that, which is like turn off our phones an hour before we go to bed. Pick up a book and read. Do a letter to someone. Don't watch Law and Order.
Not right before bed.
No,
Homeland is what
idea.
We've been doing. It definitely makes it hard to sleep.
Yeah, you know, I think you got to turn your brain down, and maybe that becomes more important as you get older because we have so many things on our minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is shifting gears a little bit from sleep and aging into labor and pregnant women, how long women should be allowed to push in labor.
Well, apparently there is a standard, which is that women generally have 3 hours to push their baby out when they're kind of their cervix fully dilated and the baby's ready to come out if they've had an epidural, and two if they haven't. And then after that, they are kind of like, well, they got to go to a C-section. But there's researchers have said, well, is that a mantra? Can we test it out, talking about challenging what's established theory and looking at data? What do they do?
So this is the case where they studied the difference to see for – they looked only with women who had an epidural to see what happened for the patients who were given the typical 3 hours to push, how many went to C-section, and then what percent of women who were given 4 hours went to C-section. And they actually found that 43% of the women who were given the 3 hours to push ended up having a C-section, and only 19.5% of the women who were given 4 hours had one. And most importantly, they also found no evidence that giving this additional time put the babies at greater risk, although they all acknowledge that we need to study that further.
So, right. And given that 30% of all births in the United States are C-sections, if we can really cut down on that, that's a great thing.
That is good for everyone. So if that's the case, you should talk with your doctor about it. It's okay to say, is it possible to get more time for that pushing phase? Okay, we're talking about daydreaming Are you going to sing a song for us?
No. Don't have a song for daydreaming, but I am going to close my eyes. And it reminds me, because this is research about, does daydreaming, people who do that, can they create more? Are there things they're doing that might be helpful? And I remember one of my mentors in research, John Rogers, who used to be at the University of Texas, he wrote an article in an academic journal that said his best research ideas came when he was laying on a raft in a pool. And I used to think that was just crazy until I tried it one time. And it's just like, wow, my mind just started thinking about things.
Right, right. Well, and I enjoyed this this article also in that my family's always made fun of me. My mom would call it zoning out. Christy's zoning out again. And just recently, my 9-year-old son started, he'd never heard my mom mention this, but he started saying, "What are you doing when your eyes go like that?" And he's like, "You're zoning out." It's a thing that people know, and I have to really focus at home to you know, to be present and to not zone out so much and daydream.
Mom Z-O-ing, as the lingo would say.
Although I do have great ideas when I'm doing that. So,
however, right. What they found in this, and it was published in the journal Psychological Science, and studying 300 young adults, and this came from one of our sister universities at University of North Carolina, Greensboro Psychology Department, kudos to them, is that when people are mind wandering, they're usually actually becoming open to experience, and they're open to things being a bit more unconventional, like new things. And in daily life, that is a good trait for a lot of things that one has to do.
Yeah, the researchers said people who daydream often during free time were more on task when they needed to be, and you know, found some associations there. So, I mean, there may be some positive things about daydreaming. Maybe that you have the space to be thinking about other things, or maybe that you're allowing your mind to wander and put new connections together.
Yeah, we just don't want all of you who have kids out there or the kids themselves to respond to their teachers, "I'm just daydreaming."
It's a good thing.
Maybe to your bosses, but you want to bring right. the study in and tell them that you're really thinking of ways to make that company and business more effective.
That's exactly Love right. It. Okay, last one, and that is about HPV, the human papillomavirus. And this was a survey that found that close to half of American adults have been infected with HPV. So that's 42% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 59 are infected with the genital human papillomavirus. And this has some ramifications in terms of its link with genital warts, with cervical cancer, and the fact that we have a vaccine now that can prevent most strains of HPV.
Yeah, and I guess one of the downsides of what is that a lot of people still aren't getting the HPV vaccine. I remember a conversation I had with a young male just recently talking about it, and he said he didn't want to get it. And the mother wanted him to get it, but he was just resistant to doing it. I think he thought, well, I'm never going to get this. And we had this conversation. And that's the issue. We really need to convince that this is something really good. I think we'll eventually get there. It's just going to take a while.
Well, and so this vaccine is available to 11 and 12-year-olds for both boys and girls. And the idea is to give it to children before they're at the age, before they're in the situation to become sexually active.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Chiminski, Director of the Physician Assistant Program at the University of North Carolina Department of Allied Health Sciences. You listen to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam, we get the opportunity to talk with Dr. Paul Chiminski, Professor of Medicine, about the new Physician Assistant Program in UNC's Allied Health Department, and we are delighted, delighted to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Christy. I'm very pleased to be here today as well.
Well, Dr. Chiminski, you know, we've known each other and Christy and your family for a long time. Your wife is one of our esteemed graduates and family physicians. But Christy and I both are just, you know, wanting to hear a little bit more about how you got started and interested both in medicine and internal medicine and pediatrics and the whole gamut of things that got you started.
Well, in the 1980s, I was a medieval and Renaissance studies major at Duke University, and I was called into the dean's office right before my last semester, and I had a talk with a sub-dean, and she said, Mr. Chelminski, you need two science courses to graduate from Duke University.
And uh-oh.
And I said, well, all the men in my family are scientists, and she said, well, that's witty and charming, but you still need two science courses to graduate from Duke. And so I fulfilled that requirement, but then I decided that I had to somehow pursue life after undergraduate. And I signed up for the Peace Corps while all my friends were signing up for investment banking opportunities and interviews at Duke. I then ended up being placed in Mali, West Africa. And I had no intent of going into medicine. No one in my family had gone to medicine. Although my parents had very sophisticated, highly educated friends, none of them happened to be physicians. So I had no role models in my life for being a physician. Journalists, inventors, scientists, artists, yes, but no physicians.
Renaissance people, but not necessarily physicians.
Yeah, and kind of I would tell people that I had basically four or five fathers, my father and his three brothers and a friend who a lot of them benefited from the GI Bill. They were self-made people in the sense that one of them was an inventor and created a piece of oil exploration equipment and started a company, and writers. And so I grew up with the example of people who kind of defined themselves, and none of the men were successful before the age of 30. So I knew it was a great example of knowing I didn't need to be in any rush.
Fantastic. And so you grew up very committed to service, decided to pursue medicine, became very well experienced as a professor of medicine. And then now you've taken on this new chapter as directing the physician's assistant program that we'll talk about today. Give us a sense of what led you to take on such an important leadership role and start a new program.
Well, when I was at Duke University, even there, most of my friends were North Carolinians, and I spent most of my first semester on Carolina's campus with my friends. And I became very enamored of the servant mission of this place. It was unlike anything I'd grown up with in Connecticut. There's no identity that accrues to the University of Connecticut in terms of a broader sense of belonging to your own state. And as a Peace Corps volunteer, when I made the decision that I was going to become a physician, I had to take pre-med courses at night in Philadelphia, but I only applied to one school, which was the University of North Carolina, because I knew that it would be easier to serve people if I was part of an institution that itself was dedicated to service. I didn't have to persuade anyone. Basically, it was a shortcut to having a career of service because I knew the university was committed to it from its foundation and for the future.
You know, Chrissy mentioned you're the director of a new physician assistant program, but I also know that that one of the motivators, and you alluded to it, is not just service, but also a commitment to serving underserved and rural populations. Tell us a little bit about your interest in rural health, and then also let's begin to understand what is a physician assistant program.
Well, I was very lucky that at the end of my internal medicine and pediatrics residency, the former chairman of family medicine, Dr. Ken Reeb, took a personal interest in me and in my development. He encouraged me to work in Siler City, North Carolina, when he was chairman of family medicine. My wife was a resident in that department, but I really felt that Dr. Reeb was interested in me, and he gave me career guidance. And I think he understood that Siler City and North Carolina would sell itself in terms of, for anyone who was observant, that there were tremendous unmet needs amongst people who were hardworking, well-intentioned, but that were not part of this great, successful academic enterprise, but who needed what we had to offer.
Even though they're just 45 minutes, an hour away, it can feel quite different.
I had gone, yes, to Duke, and even in medical school at UNC, I had no conception of how rural and southern it was, just 10 miles away from the university. I was even at medical school shielded from that reality.
So fast forward a little bit to, because you worked in some of these areas with a physician. So what is a physician assistant? I think I know I've worked with them, but you know.
This is not a UNC story. This is not a Duke story alone. This is a North Carolina story. There was expertise and wisdom in the environment from the 1950s, and a very visionary chairman of medicine at Duke named Eugene Stead saw that there was a family doctor in the community in Garland, North Carolina, named Amos Johnson, who had already developed a model with an African-American man, a collaborator named Buddy Treadwell, to deliver medicine in collaborative teams. And this team included someone with a high degree of responsibility, but who wasn't a physician per se. That developed into the physician assistant profession when Dr. Stead decided that there was a great untapped source of talent, of untapped talent and investment that was not being realized in our military corpsmen. And UNC realized the same thing at the end of the last decade, that with the wars in Iran and Iraq and other places and the special reliance on special forces, that we'd invested hundreds of millions, I would say even billions of dollars in the training of highly skilled medical professionals, but who once again were bereft of any civilian qualification when they separated from the services. These are people with 20, 30, 50, 60,000 hours of clinical service, and yet they could come back to this country and only work as nurses' aides or EMT basics. And UNC felt that because of its special relationship with the military, that it had to harness that potential, that it had an obligation to do it.
And so these are mostly people, as you describe, who've already had a lot of clinical experience, who are committed to patients already, and who just need that additional training to be able to take care of patients. Give us an idea or an example of someone, and then what typically the physician assistants do after graduation.
Well, you know, we have several examples in our program. We have one gentleman who we admitted to our program. He was 53, and he had been a special forces medic. And what he had done to pursue the medical profession was to keep training soldiers at Fort Bragg to be Green Beret medics, but he couldn't practice autonomously. And now in December, he will have received a degree from UNC, and he plans to work in rural North Carolina. And he says he's going to just work there for another 20 years. But he had all this latent commitment, this latent talent and skill set that he needed some retooling, because there is a culture difference between military and civilian medical training. But especially with the special forces medics, these people are considered to be teachers and expert learners as physicians are, in terms of ability to learn quickly and learn applied task-oriented material, not theoretical material.
And when you say that they can work autonomously, let's define what that is, because you also said collaboratively. So sometimes those two things don't always mesh together. And so how does that work in practice in terms of physician's assistant's ability? Because their training is not the exact same. It's not as long as a physician. It's you know, maybe half or maybe even shorter than that, so depending on what they do. So help us understand what they can do and who can they do it with.
Well, the team-based medical care has come late to the medical profession. It has been, you know, up until now, even a bunch of alpha individuals who have command of their separate domains and who have been taught to not be reliant on others, to be extremely self-reliant. That's not the best way to help people heal in the best sense of the word, because that's just too much responsibility for any single individual. At the same time, we're asking doctors, traditional doctors, to be able to do too many things, often to be researchers and clinicians and also educators, whereas the physician assistant training is very task-oriented. These are highly sophisticated tasks, but there's less emphasis on the theoretical aspects or our future investigations, such as research. It's very task-oriented and consistent with their roles in the military. To be a special forces operative, you have to be able to work across disciplines within your team and to be a rapid learner. I was recently at the 50th anniversary celebration of the physician assistant profession, in terms of 50 years ago in the fall, the first graduates will have graduated from Duke. And one of the PAs was telling a story, an older PA, about how he was asked to work on a project that had to do with nuclear medicine. And somebody said to him, "But you don't know anything about nuclear medicine." And he said, "Thank God for being a PA," because they're very collaborative and and plastic learners.
That's wonderful. Well, we do need to take a short break, but we will come back in just a few moments and we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Paul Chelminski, about the new physician assistant program in UNC's Allied Health Department. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Paul Chelminski, Director of UNC's Physician Assistant Program in UNC's Allied Health Department. And right before the break, Dr. Chelminski, you were really giving us a nice kind of overview of this tension or this complement between autonomy and collaboration. And it made me think of my first experience working with the physician assistant. This was almost two decades ago when there was a rural practice in Randleman that had a family doctor and a physician assistant. The family doctor died within 3 or 4 days. And the question was how to keep the practice afloat and these patients, you know, a couple thousand patients that were relying on this practice. And I was luckily in a position in my career as a fellow that I could go down there and one day a week and sign charts and collaborate during the week with the physician assistant, but really got to see this physician really did operate autonomously, but yet there were particularly some more advanced cases and just support. We worked as a team. Is that the way it works today, and is it the same way in rural populations?
Yeah, you know, I really deplore any chauvinism or territorialism of the traditional medical practice when it comes to highly skilled advanced practice practitioners like physician assistants. I have been for now 15 years collaborating with and supervising a variety of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and clinical pharmacists. And what I notice is the difference between us is not intellectual acumen. I think the major difference between me and other advanced practice practitioners is that I'm expected to have a broad spectrum of experience and knowledge. And what that allows me to do, it allows me to deal with all the uncertainty. It gives me a temperament that allows me to deal with uncertainty and a complexity to a higher level, because that's what the expectation is for me to do. But for certain tasks, such as managing medicines for blood clotting, I would not trust that to anyone other than one of my PAs. I trust him more, and I consult with him whenever I make a medication change, because it's just not safe to do otherwise. I would tell you, you know, the medical board gets sensitive about the language of autonomy or collaboration. I tell people that physician assistant profession, and for that matter, even the nurse practitioner profession, is like the autonomous region of Catalonia. They can do whatever they want except print money and go to war or make their own foreign policy. But otherwise, they are highly independent and autonomous, and they are in charge of their local culture. Because it's the person on the ground who knows the culture in any area best, especially when you're dealing with people, not machines.
Help us understand more about the types of jobs that PAs go into. So I know that our UNC program is a little more geared towards people who might go into rural North Carolina, who might serve the underserved, who might end up in primary care. And yet the statistics for APPs and for PAs in particular, usually having a very narrow specialty where they follow a specialist and do the same thing on a more narrow scope, is more common. And you were just talking about the tension of a physician maybe having more broad experience, more okay with uncertainty, and we all know that primary care involves a lot of that. So how do you wrestle with that tension, and how are you promoting PAs in your program to help meet our rural healthcare needs?
Well, I think the most important dimension of recruiting PAs to become practitioners in underserved areas is the recruiting aspect. We have been very careful. One of the reasons we recruited veterans was not just because they have a vast reservoir of experience that can be refocused, but also because we know that veterans live in communities that are often underserved. And we know from the literature, you know, in graduate medical education of resident physicians that they're most likely to practice where they finish their training. Mm-hmm. So first of all, we've recruited the veterans because they're more likely to go back to stable community situations. And what we're seeing already is that they intend to do that. Second of all, we cast a broad net beyond the medical center. We recruited we could easily recruit all of our PA students from very talented, academically qualified people within a 3-mile radius of the medical center. But for instance, we have a woman who's married to a PA in Robeson County, which is a very poor and depressed county. She was working at a bank. She wants to become a pediatric PA. She's originally from Mexico. She's married to a Native American Olumbee individual who is a PA. Wow. She's going to be a tremendous, a formidable asset to her community. And there's no way that she and her husband and their kids are going to leave that community. And so far, we have several other people, two women who were athletic trainers. Well, one was an athletic trainer, rather, from Yadkinville area. And they were both very much affected by the closure of their critical access hospital. And they have every intention to go back to that community and practice rural medicine. And I have every reason to believe that they are going to do so.
So the left arm goes up, it says admit. The right arm goes up, that says admit. You got at least four admits to if there was any question mark. Let me ask you a question. The potential, the excitement, the vision really comes through. What are the challenges you face getting a new program going and also assuring that you really meet that mission and vision? What are the challenges you're facing?
Well, the main challenge, and we've seen this already, is that we have three groups of people. We have veterans, we have non-traditional students, and we have trads, traditional students. And honestly, the traditional students, the ones who are just a year or two out from NC State or UNC, are much more well-conditioned learners. And they handle the early curriculum, which is basic science, with much less difficulty. But last year, we had a few of the military people, and the military people almost by definition have a non-traditional academic group. They've been cobbling together their degrees, and cobbling in the best sense of the word, they've been doing whatever they can to get these degrees at places like Campbell, and they do not excel early on in a very structured and test-heavy academic environment. One person who struggled mightily got to her clinical rotations in OBGYN, and within 3 weeks of her first rotation, this person had been a flight medic in the Air Force. They were offering her a job because she was so reliable, her hands were so good, her attitude was so good. But our major challenge is to not prejudge these people and winnow them away because we're subjecting them to a curriculum structure that they have never seen before. And that's our job to pull these people through those first few months. And we've already altered our curriculum.
So I know that our time's coming to a close, but when you look at this next chapter, you've launched this program, you've got some time under your belt, and as you look at this next chapter and this next horizon for UNC's physician assistant program, what do we have to look forward to?
Well, I would say that in a few years we will look forward to an expansion of the program. It's a small program now. I think also, you know, the UNC Physician Assistant Program is a way that UNC is keeping itself fresh. There's really no research in a university, I would say maybe in the world, that has such a kind of a paradoxical mission, a mission to be a great research university, but also strong ties to its community of support, which is the state of North Carolina. And we have to keep ourselves fresh and relevant. And I am positive that people around the state will see this program as an example of how UNC keeps it fresh in terms of its great servant mission to the state.
Well, I'm certain that it's not just around the state where people notice, but I'm sure it's nationally, because there are lots of ways that this need that you're discussing really is projected nationally, sometimes internationally. And I also want to make a comment that whereas you perhaps came to UNC because of its tradition of service, helping to inculcate yourself, it's clear from what you've discussed with us today that you have enriched UNC and pushed us to do better than we would have done ourselves. So thank you.
Well, there are not many times in your life where you get to add value at five levels: to patients, to students, to an institution, and to a state, and to yourself. And, you know, one last story is that last year I was at the Special Operations Medical Association scientific session in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Special Operations soldiers from all over the world come to discuss what it takes to be a field medic. And UNC gave a presentation on what it would take for a special ops soldier to become a PA. And at the end of it, a Colonel Lutz, who's an emergency room physician, he walked by me and he stuck out his hand to shake my hand, and he said, "Thank you for helping the boys." And that was the most meaningful thing that's been said to me in the last 2 years.
Wow. Remarkable. Remarkable your story, and remarkable the kind of impact that you're having on so many people at multiple levels. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Chelminski.
Thank you, Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein.
We've been talking with Dr. Paul Chelminski about the new physician assistant program in UNC's Allied Health Department. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back with House Calls.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, just send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I recently went on Augmentin for 10 days. A week after finishing the Augmentin, I broke out in hives. Could the two be related?
Well, this reminds me, Laura, of one of those questions you get on a multiple choice test. And we know there are code words in there. What's the code word in there? They put a could thing. It's yes, absolutely. Yes. And the short answer is, yes, they could be related. Okay. Most people think, oh, it can't be related because, you know, I stopped the medicine 2 weeks ago. But, you know, these medicines have some delayed immunologic sorts of things that can occur.
Okay.
It's probably less likely to.
Okay.
But it certainly could be related. And matter of fact, the Augmentin is with any antibiotic. I don't know if you've ever had an antibiotic reaction, but a lot of people have to something or a reaction to some medicine.
Yeah.
Turns out I can't be in the hot tub that has bromide. My skin, I'll develop an allergic reaction to bromide within like 6 or 8 hours. So you can develop it, but usually it's before you have the exposure and then you develop it.
Okay.
In this particular case, I'd have lots of questions like,
okay,
what else did you take? Could it have been you had the antibiotics for an infection? Could the infection have caused it?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else change that's going on? Part of it is hives are really frequent. Augmentin people taking it is really frequent. So there's going to be a certain overlap and they're coexisting. It's kind of like, you know, you get a shot, a flu shot, and then you develop a cold. You think, oh, I must have gotten the cold from the flu shot. Whereas a lot of times people get flu shots all the time. People get colds all the time in winter. Ah.
It just happens.
Those two things are going to happen together a lot. So in this particular case, they may be related. They may not be related. The answer on the multiple chest question would be
Maybe, yes. They could be related.
It's reasonable to be very cautious about taking Augmentin in the future. That would be the thing you would want to watch for. Could you take it again? Well, the answer is maybe cautiously, but you'd be better off probably taking something else that's not related.
Okay.
Great question. What's our very next house call?
I recently started taking prednisone last week, and I think my sleep has been affected. Do you have any advice for me?
Well, I guess the first thing we know is, do you think they could be related, Laura?
Yes, they could. It could be related.
Yeah, and this listener didn't say, could they be related? But I'm reading through the lines here. And what's ironic, and I certainly know we've got some prednisone takers out there, and we probably have some prednisone takers out there who had their sleep disrupted. And I remember the first time I heard this from a patient, I was like, well, wait a second. Prednisone is an anti-inflammatory. Now, yeah, but when I take it, it makes me wired.
Really?
And I've heard that a number of times from patients. Most patients, it doesn't. But some patients, it really just kind of gear them up. So a lot of times when I give people prednisone, I say, oh, and by the way, if it makes you all wired, you know, you may need to, particularly on a higher dose of the prednisone. So in this particular case, I think it certainly could be affected. I've had people have nightmares on prednisone. Seems kind of strange.
Yeah. Wow.
But if you think about it, I don't know if you've ever heard, you know, people have cancer. They have brain cancer. What's one of the drugs that the neurosurgeon sends put people with brain cancer on? It's these potent steroids, Decadron, a potent steroid to cut down on the swelling in the brain.
Yeah.
So if we know it has effects on the brain therapeutically, it shouldn't be surprised too much that it could have problems the other direction. A lot of things can affect sleep, though, right? I mean, we know both medications affect sleep, stress affects sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You might have had that illness that you're taking the prednisone on that the sleep is a problem, you know. But I think number one culprit probably is, in this case, prednisone.
Do you think it matters what time of day you take it? I mean, would that help this listener out?
Not really, because actually most people can take prednisone only once a day.
Okay.
You don't have to break it up into two. Like if they say, doctor says, take 10 milligrams three times a day,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean you can't take 30 milligrams at one time. Your body sees it one time and it okay. stays in your system for that period of time.
Gotcha.
And actually, I should have said this about Augmentin. Some medications actually can stay in your system for a long time. I had a patient years ago who was given a medication for malaria prevention. And 2 weeks after they got back, they became psychotic. Now, how do you think that is? Yeah, they're walking around the street, I don't think with many clothes on.
That's awful.
And it turned out that this medicine stays in your system so long, that's when it started affecting them. Much more difficult diagnosis to make in that particular case. But if you don't think about it, you don't make the diagnosis.
Yeah, it sounds like those side effects can be challenging, especially when it doesn't necessarily correlate with when you're actually taking the medication. That's crazy.
What's our very next house call? Hopefully something not about a medication that causing a side effect.
This listener decided to be a little bit of a gymnast and says, I recently did a somersault and woke up the next morning with terrible back spasms for the first time in my life. I'm also 30 years old. Obviously, this was a mistake. What do I do now?
Well, clearly, welcome to your 30s. Let me tell you, when you get to your 40s, even the bending over might be a problem. When you get to your 50s, even stooping down could be a problem. No. Yeah, I think there's probably some things we haven't been told here, Laura. I suspect the somersault occurred potentially with some alcohol in the system here. You know,
there might have been a glass of wine involved in this one.
Yeah, probably one glass of wine to decide to do the somersault, another one to actually do it.
Yep.
And you know, it's the irony, of course, is doing a somersault, which is fun to do when you're about 7 and to about 12, and particularly on a carpet.
Right.
The problem is, if you think about what's happening, you're moving quickly and your neck can snap.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different than you're in a car that comes to a sudden still by someone hitting you from behind, you hit someone in front, and your neck snaps?
Right.
You know, it's the snapping of the neck that in a rapid motion that then comes to a stop. Now, imagine when you're doing the somersault, you know, when you landed, maybe it was your feet that landed, you would think you could hurt that back. But I could easily see, particularly maybe a little neck arthritis that has starting to develop, and it all of a sudden it flares. But
it's not
painful.
Surprising that it would cause this.
It really does sound painful.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was the back spasms, not the neck spasms. But not really a surprise. It may have landed on something a little wrong, may have been done on a hard floor. It's like the people who do handstands sometimes. I think those are great, except when you fall.
Yeah, the impact.
You know, the only time I think it's probably okay to do the somersaults, maybe when you're rolling into the pool.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or have a nice cushion there. What do you think they should do? Just relax, take it easy.
Ice it maybe.
Ice for the pain, heat for the relaxation.
Yeah.
A little gentle massage.
Yeah. Not do somersaults next time.
Not do somersaults with those two glasses of wine. Yeah. I think all of those things are good. Maybe we should try out that massage first and see how it works.
Yeah.
Make sure it's safe. Okay. What's our very last house call?
There's a spot on my hand that I think is a wart. It recently began to itch, and it now has a darkened skin around it, almost like there's a tanned circle surrounding it. Should I be concerned?
Well, you are concerned.
Yeah, you wrote in.
Yeah, that, you know, and there's nothing normal about most of that. You think it's a wart? Okay, that's fair enough. Warts are common on the hand. They're not usually so dark, but warts that get irritated for any reason could be changing. A wart that's now itching, yeah, that could happen. Also, other lesions can itch. Skin cancers can itch. Anytime a skin lesion is changing, particularly if it turns dark, itches, changing, oops. That's three of the five warning signs, you know, A, B, C, D.
So even if it's the skin around it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If something's changing on it, go need to see the provider, dermatologist, primary care physician. May or may not need a biopsy, may need to treat it. It could be a pre-skin cancer. Could be a wart. It could be neither of the above, but it probably needs to be checked out. You're worried. We can take care of it easily.
Right. Great.
Well, those are some great questions today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope you've enjoyed the questions, the comments, the conversation with Dr. Paul Chiminski. And you can send us your own stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Paul Chiminski. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, Dr. Christy Page and I want to thank you for listening in, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.